the tenth temptation, where they despise the pleasant land. Maybe a few comments can be made on the ninth temptation, which would be the 12th chapter. Perhaps we could read the 13th chapter and the first five verses of chapter 14. Simply because of time, we don't have time to read the whole account. Perhaps, yeah. Temptations. Since this will be the last reading. In Numbers 11, we had that the seventh temptation, first three verses. And there, as we understand it, there was a despising of God's order in the camp as to how he arranged the tents, the children, the tribes, and so on around the tent of testimony. Apparently, there were some that didn't get a position that they felt was right. Some were closer to the tabernacle than others, and there was a complaining and murmuring, apparently. So we have a despising of God's order in the camp, and the ordering of the camp. And then we had from verse 4 of chapter 11, the despising of the food, the manna. So we see there that God's dealings with them in lessons. Then in chapter 12, we have despising of God's leader, Moses, and when he had a life that was impeccable, meekest man in all the earth, we're told in that 12th chapter, and was serving the Lord with fervence and with energy. They could not find anything to attack him with regard to his service. They went after his personal life and found a woman. And the woman that he had married, being an Ethiopian or a black woman, a Cushite, has been told, at least I've learned, that this woman is the same woman that we read of in Exodus 2, Zipporah, apparently. There's a verse in Habakkuk chapter 3 that tells us that the Midianites, which Zipporah was, and the Cushites had intermingled and integrated as far as the genealogies are concerned, and that gave the Midianites a very dark colored skin. So if that's correct, I picked it up in one of the old periodicals as answers to questions. And if that is correct, this is the same woman, apparently, as Zipporah, though she is not mentioned by name. Someone said that this is the chapter of the black and white woman, the two women, a black woman, and by the end of the chapter we find that there is a white woman, a woman that was covered from head to foot, leprous, white as snow. She had taken the lead, apparently, in criticizing her brother Moses, and Aaron had joined with that, and God had passed a judgment on them for judging the man whom God had raised up to lead and be a help to his people. And I suppose the lesson we're to get from that is that we better be careful to criticize, to call down those whom God has raised up to be a help, to nourish his people in whatever degree that they have been used of him. Interesting to notice that when this insult was thrown at Moses, that he did not defend himself. It says he was the meekest man on all the earth. It was the Lord that spake suddenly, and he took care of the matter. And so although Miriam did not like the color of the skin of this woman, God changed the color of her skin. And the camp, she was shut out of the camp for a period of time, taught by discipline, not to attack one of God's people, and especially a leader. Very much more could be said about that chapter. But passing on to chapters 13 and 14, we have the 10th temptation. As we mentioned in chapter 14, it was read to us but verse 22 tells us that there were these 10 temptations. And we followed them through in the last meeting or so. We come now to the 10th and final murmuring of the children of Israel in this stage of their wilderness journey. And the subject here is the pleasant land being despised. God's land being despised. So if you go over these four that I'm speaking now, we have God's order being despised, God's food being despised, God's leaders being despised, and now God's land. The pleasant land is despised. But this chapter, this 13th chapter, is very instructive as to what leads up to the despising of the pleasant land. And surely we can get something for our souls this afternoon out of it.
You were mentioning the number 10 in regard to the temptations. And verse 22 of our chapter 14 specifies there, because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, pronounces a judgment on them.
If they had been in the right state, they would not have needed these men to go up into the land to bring back the two things that Moses told them to bring. It was something that they had doubts about, apparently, in the land, and actually suggested to Moses that they send spies, or as others have put it, scouts ahead. I think that's Deuteronomy chapter 1, isn't it? Verse 22 of Deuteronomy 1 tells us that the idea came from their hearts and the Lord permitted it. And you came near unto me, every one of you, and said, we will send men before us, and they shall search us out of the land and bring us word again by what way we must go up and into what cities we must come. And the saying pleased me well, and I took 12 men of you, one of a tribe. So 12 men are chosen out, and they are sent into the land to do two things. Number one, in verse 18, is to see the land. And secondly, in verse 20, is to bring the fruit of the land. And these two things, by their experience in the land, they were to bring back to the children of Israel who were still in the wilderness and present the evidence and the fruits of the land to them, that it might awaken an interest and a desire and a hunger and thirst for that good land that flowed with milk and honey, and to stir them up for the possession of it. And typically this would speak to us, I believe, of how that God has raised up men to go into heavenly things, the portion that is ours, and to learn of these things by their personal walking and, shall we say, investigation, and learning the truth of God, whereby they can bring it back to the people of God and to share it with them and to awaken their hearts and their interest in divine things. The Lord is interested in stirring up our appetite and interest in the heavenly things that are ours. The land of Canaan, of course, answers to our heavenly portion. what we find there in Ephesians would correspond very nicely with the land. They were promised a portion there in the land of Canaan, and so we too have got a portion of blessings that are ours. But the Lord doesn't want us to wait until we get to heaven to enter into how richly we have been blessed and to know these wonderful things that are ours. He has given us the Spirit of God, and the Spirit of God takes the Word of God and opens these things up to us. And more than that, He's given to us gifts. Gifts to the church have been given for the purpose of awakening the interest in, and building up the saints in the most holy faith, and to lead them into these heavenly truths and to help in that way.
Isn't that a kind of an anomaly that they could bring back all the fruit of the land and yet not enjoy it themselves? And isn't that a danger? You know, sometimes God would send in some who can bring great things out of the Word of God, but you get the sense that they're not enjoying them themselves. One time a man said that there was a man, he could play the piano just beautifully. He had a gift, and he could just make that thing send out the most beautiful music. But he was very happy to, when it was all over and he could retire from it and the act was all over or the recital was all over. But there were people in the audience who couldn't play a stroke, but they enjoyed that music. They loved to hear that music. And sometimes it's that way in the things of God. You know, one can perhaps bring forth these things. The real test is, are they enjoying it? Here they had all this fruit from the land. They'd have faith to go in and enjoy it themselves. That's a word to our heart, I think, isn't it? I mean, we, especially as gathered saints, we speak of these wonderful things that we have. But are we enjoying them? Or are we taken up with, some of the murmurings, the criticisms of God's people? And you know, though we have these Eshcol's grapes to feast on, perhaps we're feasting on the wrong thing. Our soul's not enjoying what God really has for us.
Well, they had forgotten, hadn't they, what God had promised to them when they left the land of Egypt. And he said he was going to take them into a country that flowed, as Bruce just mentioned, that flowed with milk and honey. But he also told them that the Canaanite and those different ones would be there. And sure enough, when the report came back in regard to the land, they told about the enemies that were in the land. And it was this that deterred the people, changed their minds from wanting to go into the land.
They were told in the 17th verse, "Get you up into this way southward and go up into the mountain." You notice there that those two words, those two ups, they were to get into the mountain and they were to view, verse 18, and see the land, but they were to view it from that perspective, from that that mountain, that exalted place. They were to get, as much as they were able, God's perspective on the land. And especially, they were to get God's perspective on the people that dwelled therein. Whether they be strong or weak or few or many, and what the land is like and so on. And I wonder if they really did that. That is, if that's the perspective that they viewed the enemies of the land and viewed the land from God's side. Because later on we see that they compare themselves to these giants. if they really had have taken it from the heavenly side, they would have seen those giants as little wee things. And so that view from the mountain would have really, I think, if they had have taken it that way, would have preserved them. It's sort of like David. You remember that when he went down into the valley and he said to Goliath, he said, God will deliver you into my hand. And there's that big giant with six fingers on each hand and so on. But later on in his life, when he's going from cave to cave and from running from Saul, he says in his discouragement, one day I will die by the hand of Saul. And so he compared, in the beginning, when he had God's perspective of Goliath, beautiful the way he looks at Goliath as an enemy of the Lord's people, he says, God will deliver you into my hand. He compared the hand of Goliath to the hand of God. Then later on in his life, when he has already been promised to be king, he compares his hand to the hand of Saul, and he's discouraged. He does not have that heavenly perspective as we have in this chapter. And how often we get in trouble ourselves if we don't have that divine perspective, that heavenly perspective of the mountain.
Well, there were two of the messengers that were sent that I think saw it from a different perspective from what you mentioned.
Yeah, true.
And it's good to see that there was a Joshua and a Caleb who brought back the right report of what the land was.
But the point that we need to see, I think Vern has already alluded to it, and that is that what was it that caused the people to want to go back to Egypt, as we read, to get a captain and go back to Egypt? It was what report that these men brought back. And it's true, I'm speaking now of the 10 men apart from the two, that it's possible that we could minister of things that we have seen and heard and know of as far as what is right doctrinally in such a way as that it does not give the saints of God a heart to want to go on into those things, but rather makes them want to return to Egypt. It's a very solemn thing to think that we could minister in such a way that it really is causing the saints of God to want to return to Egypt. And another thing too, you'll notice, as it was read to us, that what these 10 men said, there's not one thing that they said which was a lie. They did not make or say anything that was untrue. They said true things, but they presented it in such a way as that it disheartened the people and discouraged them. The people are strong. Was that true? Yes. And they had walled cities. Yes. Was there giants there? Yes. They presented it from a particular perspective that did not encourage the hearts of the saints to want to go in. So this is something that lays at the feet of every one of us who do take part publicly in public ministry. Do we minister in such a way as it gives the saints a taste of divine things and makes them want to go on, or does it dishearten them? Well, historically, we know that it's been the teachers in the church that have caused the church to go into the world. Bringing up a line of things that is not necessarily not true, but presenting it in such a way is that separation is broken down and there is, shall we say, I wouldn't want to say an encouraging to go to Egypt, but rather causing the saints to want to return to Egypt. And this is what kindled the anger of the Lord. These men were dealt with by a plague. Verse 37 of chapter 14 tells us. They brought up an evil report in verse 37. And as a result, God allowed special discipline upon them, and they died by a plague before the Lord. Speaking to some before us here, I think there's something like 6 or 7 plagues that you'll find in the wilderness. We often speak of the 10 plagues in Egypt. An interesting study would be to take up the plagues in the wilderness. But that's another subject. That will be left for another time. Let me put it this way. Is it possible that I could minister the word in such a way as that I cause the saints of God to want to go to Egypt or to return to Egypt?
I'm trying to think of how you would do that.
Well, to present the things of God in such a complicated manner, or perhaps a way that would prove that they're going to have superhuman strength to get a hold of these things. As they said, you know, you're going to have these walled cities and there's giants. Only the fittest and the most able soldiers will ever be able to overcome that. And of course, the average child of God is going to say, well, I can't do that. I'm not a gifted person. I don't have a Darby or Kelly-like mind. And so they fold their hands and say, I couldn't do it. And they leave it for others. And meanwhile, their soul might drift back into the world. That might be an example. There's some interesting things here in verse 21 and 22 for all of us. If they were going to search the land, they had to do it in a way that, as we see here, first of all, to go up, might speak to us of elevation or nearness to God. If we're going to learn the truth that is ours and be instructed in our portion, we need to do it in nearness to God. You'll notice that it says in verse 22 that they ascended by the south and came unto Hebron. Hebron means communion and fellowship. And it's only in communion and fellowship with the Lord that we're going to be able to go into these divine things. To traffic in it any other way, to take another way into the land, is going to mean that we will meet with the dangers that are there. It seems that Hebron was the portal by which they were to make their entrance into that land. They had to go up through Hebron. And we are to go up through communion and fellowship into our portion. As someone once said, we shouldn't be reading books of ministry with the Bible closed or nowhere near at hand. We need to be taking up the written ministry and these rich things with an open Bible and in a prayerful state. So that we go into these things and we learn them in communion. Or we'll be just like this man that Vern was telling us about that played the musical instrument without any heart.
That was an amazing thing that you could go in and get all these the fruits of the land, you know, the grapes, and flowed with milk and honey. And here they were. It was in a desert where nothing grew. You know? And yet it wasn't. It wasn't before them in such a way that they would trust God when He'd already given it to them to go up and get it. They would rather live in the desert, wouldn't they? Where there was nothing grew than to go in and take that land that God had given them and told them He'd give it unto them. And I suppose so it is with us. If we get occupied with other things than what God has given us to enjoy.
They probably covered about 350 miles. And said that if you take the wilderness of Zin, verse 21, unto Rehob, as men come to Hamath, that's about 160 miles as the crow flies, I've been told. And of course, you know, we don't go as the crow flies, the road meanders and so on. So it could be, let's say, 175 miles if they were going through like that. And then you have to make the return route, return journey, so it's at least double that. We're looking at perhaps 350 miles that they traversed in those 40 days. So they were well acquainted with the land by the time they got back. They had seen the valleys and the hills. They had seen the beautiful portions. And it was at a time of year when the grapes were lush and ripe. The fruit was there for the taking. There were two that brought an enormous cluster of grapes that had to be borne on a staff between them. It must have been an incredible sight to see. I wonder who those two were. And doesn't that speak to us of fellowship? You know, it's one thing to be able to have taken in something through walking in the truth, and have learned it, and to seek to share it with others. But you'll go a lot further, if we could put it this way, if we can share it, or if two can share it, in fellowship. Two work sometimes much better, or most times much better than one. Take a Bible reading. When things are left to one person, you may get more when there is the fellowship participating. So we have these two men working together to bring this fruit to the people.
How would you do that? Could you do that without on a pole and one using his left foot and the other on his right? You'd have to keep a step, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
With one another. In order to carry that smoothly for 120 miles. But it seemed that these two, Joshua and Caleb, it seemed that they were in step with one another. They were enjoying these things together.
So we need to learn to work together in a Bible reading. That may seem like a very elementary thought, but this is something that escapes some. Perhaps not able or conscious of being able to work with your brethren in the sense of bringing food to the saints in a public way. Speaking to a brother one time, he was mentioning, I can't remember where he was, but he ran into H.E. Hayhoe, the old Mr. Hayhoe, was long with the Lord, and he had found out where he'd come from. He said he'd come from the assembly in Ottawa. And he said, "Oh, Ottawa." And he thought of somebody he knew there. He said, "Oh, you know Brother So-and-so," and he named another brother's name. And Mr. Hayhoe said, "Oh, yes, we know him. He's the brother that throws the wrench into the works of the reading meeting all the time." That's not working together, is it? That's not keeping in step, as you were mentioning. When a line of things is being brought out and being developed in a reading, it's best to work with that rather than to try to always give the flip side of it, to negate it, or as has often been said, you know, well, we're trying to balance this out, because it may take away from the edge or the power of the line of ministry that may be being brought home, especially if it's something that's practical for the heart and conscience. Now, I'm not talking about doctrinal. If something is being put forth doctrinally wrong, it may need to be adjusted. I'm speaking of moral and practical truth. Because there's a number of different ways in which the Word of God could be taken up, a chapter, let's say. Did you agree with that? Is that right? And of course, the staff speaks to us of dependence. Anyone who would seek to be a help and refreshing and bringing food to the saints of God always needs to be upon their knees and in dependence upon Him. Staff speaks to us of a support that's without ourselves. that we lean upon. So all these things point to us of the way in which, shall we say, ministry should be brought in a public way to God's people. Well, this is what they were supposed to do. This is what did happen. But there were 10 that brought an evil report. One more thought about verse 25. It says that they were searching the land. That brings before us a little bit more of the thought, more than the thought of just casually opening your Bible and reading. There was purpose involved here. There was energy involved. They were searching. You know, we've often spoken of that verse in 1 Timothy chapter 4. And I think someone reminded me of it yesterday. Perhaps you could just read it again here. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6. Laying these things before the brethren, thou shalt be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished up in words of faith and of good doctrine, whereunto thou hast fully followed up. I've been reading Mr. Darby's translation in there. But the presentation publicly of the truth of God must be brought forward in such a way that the saints can get a hold of it, first of all, but secondly, that it must be in subjects that we fully have followed up, that we, there's been energy in searching out the matter, so that when we step forward and speak on a subject, that we may not be an authority altogether on the subject, but at least we have done some search, that we are confident that what we are saying and putting forward is indeed the truth. And all this involves a search, which I take it to equal to energy in these things. We mustn't put all the blame on the people, though, on the 10 who brought the evil report. It says in verse 26 that they brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So they were to, they brought these two things. But if you turn over to Hebrews chapter 4, it says that the word was not mixed with faith when they heard the gospel. This is a gospel that they brought, you know, the good news of the heavenly land. And it was not mixed with faith on the part of the people. So when they brought the word to them, they did not receive it. So not only were the 10 that brought the report perhaps presenting it from a side that did not awaken a real interest, but there was a state in the people that answered to that and caused them to lift up their voice, to weep and to murmur and to complain. What they were saying in verses 27, 28, 29 was, it's true that it's a land of milk and honey. What God has said, it is true. And there's lots of fruit of it. And here's an example of it. The grapes and the pomegranates and the figs. But you're going to have to be some sort of a student to ever get it. You're going to have to be a soldier and a half. They've got giants the size of trees. They've got walled cities. And this difficulty and that difficulty. And of course, what it did, it caused the people to think that there's no possible way that they could, in themselves, even though they had the Lord, of course, that would help them, be able to take this. The average person couldn't reach it. So we want to bring the food and the fruit of God to the level of where the saints are, bring them to where they are, they're in the wilderness, but to present it in such a way is that everyone says, well, I want that, and I think I can understand that, I can get a hold of that, and I'm going to search these things out a little more when I get home, because I understand what's being said there. And I think that's the mark of good ministry, is that it not only leads the heart out after Christ, but after those heavenly things where Christ is, and sets the person in movement toward those things.
Oh, and as soon as Caleb gets his opportunity here, it seems that there was already, Caleb could sense in the hearts of the people there was some intrepidation about this. And as soon as he can, he says, he stilled the people with his words. And that's nice. He calmed their fears, he tried to anyway. But you can see his desire for the land coming out. And that is a beautiful thing. It goes back to the illustration Vern was giving us before, that there is real desire in this man. And although he is, it doesn't sound like Caleb is the primary speaker in the first few verses here, but as soon as he has an opportunity to speak, you can just see his desire for that, for those heavenly things, for that land. And that in itself is very encouraging. That kind of thing is contagious. Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." And that sort of puts away this thought of it requires specially bred men or abnormally energetic people, because it says here, we are well able to overcome it. Because it was not really within their own power, as we know, to go in and overtake these enemies. But it was in their association with the God of Israel that they would be able to do it. And so it is with us. We might say, yes, but Bruce, it does take special energy. And would you disagree with that?
It takes the energy of faith.
And that's what it is. That's the special energy. And so we may take inventory and say, well, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could even stay sitting in one place long enough to read my Bible all that long. And so, but as you said, it's the energy of faith. And that is not something that is part of the human nature.
It would appear that Joshua and Caleb, two overcomers, but they were badly outnumbered by the rest of the children of Israel, because in the 31st verse it says, "But the man that went up with them said, we be not able to stand against the people, for they are stronger than we." And didn't God say, "There shall not be a man be able to stand before thee"? They were God fighting for them and with them. There would not be an enemy that would be able to stand against them. But they're looking at this in their own power. We be not able to go up against the people.
How is it that Caleb was able to still the people? It's because he was first a searcher of the land. And he was a testifier of those good things. He was able to still the people and to speak with real conviction, because he had tasted and had seen. And if we want our ministry to have any power, we need to have personally tasted of those things so that we can speak with real enjoyment of it, and people can tell that what you're saying is true because they can see in your life. Having said all that, even though there was definitely that with Caleb and Joshua, the people were not receiving it. And so they desire a captain to take them back to Egypt. This shows us that Egypt was not yet out of their hearts. This displeased the Lord greatly. Of course, Joshua and Caleb and Moses. And they are made to feel the consequences of this, because this chapter takes up the turning back now into the wilderness. And they're sent back into the wilderness to wander 38 years. Although he says 40 years in verse 34, which would be the total number of years in the wilderness. We now come to the third stage of the journey at this 14th chapter, where he says that they will go back and wander in verse 33. You know there's four stages to the journey. I don't know if we mentioned that already. The first stage, of course, was from Egypt to the mountain, Mount Sinai, where the law was given. The second stage of the journey is what we've just covered, from chapters 10 to 14, which took only 11 days. The second stage of the journey was very short, 11 days. We learned that from Deuteronomy chapter 1. Which, by the way, that verse in Deuteronomy chapter 1 is so very often misused or misapplied. So many people think that it's talking about the journey, the distance of the journey from Egypt to Canaan being 11 days. But that's not what that verse says. It tells us that from Mount Sinai, which is where the leg of the first stage brought them to, from Sinai up to Kadesh Barnea, which is where we are now, at this 14th chapter. Oh, that's Mount Sinai. By the way of Mount Seir unto Kadesh Barnea. That's the second stage of the journey. The third stage is a long stage, and that was, or section of the journey, if you could put it that way. That was the 38 years. Which they went from Kadesh Barnea to, of all places, Kadesh Barnea. They came right back to the same place where they went all along, which means that they indeed did what it says here. They wandered. And there's a difference between journeying and wandering. And you'll notice that the first 2 years they were journeying. But when it came to this point, it says that they wandered. And from hereafter they wandered. Through the 38 years. To journey would mean to travel with a destiny in view, with an object in view. But to wander is to journey without any destiny in view and not really have any object. And that's what they did. They just went in circles almost in the desert for those 38 years. And they returned, of all places, to Kadesh. And then the last stage, which is what took them up into the land, is what's given in Deuteronomy, Numbers 21 and verse 10. Numbers 21 and verse 10 is where that's marked. And for the first time now in 38 years, you read it, I'm not wandering anymore from camp to camp, but they journey again. It says they set forward and pitched in Oboth, but that word should be journeyed.
Which word?
It's Numbers 21 and verse 10. And the reason why that they are now journeying and they're making progress toward the land is because they have finally come to a judgment of sin in the flesh, typified in the brazen serpent being lifted up. They've come to an end of themselves, and they've passed judgment on it. There is a confession. We have sinned, and it's from the heart. And when self-judgment and confession and repentance is real, then there's going to be blessing and progress. You see, each time these things that we've looked at, you'll find that they sin, they fail, but there's no confession or acknowledgement of it, so they fall back into the same thing and it's sort of tumbling along. But now, here in the 21st chapter, they come to an end of it and they pass judgment on themselves, and all of what you see there typified in the serpent on the pole. And immediately you find that they begin to make steps toward the land, and the fourth stage of the journey begins, and it's all journeying and moving forward and making progress. And it's quite interesting to notice too that in every camp they find water. Well, they were complaining that they couldn't find water before that, but now you find in each of these verses in Numbers 21 water being mentioned. I think it's 7 times in a series of maybe 7 or 8 verses. Maybe I just point that out here before we close. I'm just trying to wrap up some of our thoughts. Numbers 21 verse 10, it says that they pitched an oboth. Well, oboth means water skins. And then verse 11, they journeyed from Oboth and pitched in Ijearim. And that means heaps of passages of creeks. There were creek beds, literally, in the wilderness, which was before Moab, toward the sunrise. Notice again, they removed from thence and they pitched in the valley of Zered, which means, or it should be translated, the torrent of Zered, which is a large creek bed where there was water. And Zered means willow, and I've been told that willows always will grow near or around water. And then you move along, verse 14. Wherefore it is said of the book of the wars of the Lord, that what he did in the Red Sea and in the brooks of Arnon. So now they've come to brooks of water. I think that's the 5th mention of water in this few verses. Then verse 15. At the stream of the brooks that go down to the dwelling of Ar, that lieth at the border of Moab. There's another mention of water. And then in verse 16, from thence they went to Beer. Well, Beer means wells of water. And that was the well thereof that the Lord spake of unto Moses, gather the people together, and I will give them water. And it's there that they dug a new well, and they sung unto it, and more water came forth. So, when the soul is put right morally with God in judgment, self-judgment, and is willing to walk in God's path, to submit to God's will, you find blessing and refreshment at every step. They're tripping over the water almost, where they had been complaining those years for so long. So how different the wilderness comes now when you get to that fourth stage.
Well, having said all that in regard to the journey, how long should it have taken the children of Israel to travel from Egypt to Canaan without the wilderness?
Well, I don't know if it actually specifies.
I think that's where so many have got the idea that it's 11 days.
Yeah.
But as you point out, perhaps it's... Anyway, it's a very short period of time in comparison to what they had, what they... did eventually travel 40 years and I don't know how many miles.